Hello and welcome to the second series of ETY podcast, Voices from the World of Work. I am Bianca Luna Fabris, Communications Officer at the ETY, and I am the host for this season. In this episode, I will be joined by Sotiria Theodoropoulou. Sotiria has been working at the ETY since 2010, and she is head of the European Economic Employment and Social Policies Unit. Today, we will be focusing mainly on the economic policy priorities set by the European Union and the overall economic developments of 2020. If you don't mind, Sotiria, let's start from the most recent event. What is the autumn package that has just been released by the European Commission?
The autumn package is a set of documents, hence the term package. And every year its launch, sometime in November, marks the beginning of next year's European semester. The European semester itself is the framework of coordination in a form of an annual cycle of member states' economic policies. So national economic policy plans are submitted by the member states to the European Commission, and they are discussed and recommendations are issued by the Commission and later on approved by the Council of Ministers. So to kickstart this European semester, the European Commission every autumn publishes this set of documents which outline the economic policy priorities which are meant to guide member states in shaping their fiscal and other economic policies. And these documents normally include the annual sustainable growth survey, the draft joint employment report. It's still a draft because it has to be approved later on by the Council. There is the alert mechanism report, which monitors macroeconomic imbalances, and it is a result of the reform of the economic governance framework in the previous decade. There is a policy recommendation for the euro area, a set of policy recommendations for the euro area, and the single market performance reform, as well as the positions of the European social partners on the annual sustainable and growth survey.
We saw, however, that the annual Sustainable Growth Survey was launched earlier this year, in September. Why was this the case?
Yeah, indeed, there was a small upset, if we can call it this way, in the cycle this year, with the annual Sustainable and Growth Survey being launched on the 17th of September. And this is due to the agreement that was reached in July among member states on putting together a recovery plan for the EU, to include, apart from the multi-annual financial framework for 2021-2027, which is also known as the EU budget, the next generation EU pillar, which is a recovery instrument for member states of the EU, the main instrument of which is the Recovery and Resilience Facility. Now, this instrument, when I say instrument, I mean really, you know, a pot of funds, a pot of money, will provide up to 312 billion euros in grants, so money that member states will receive and will not have to pay back, and up to 360 billion euros in loans at very low interest rates to EU member states. And this support package is meant to help member states in their efforts to mitigate the economic and social impact of the pandemic, make European economies and societies more sustainable and resilient and better prepared for the challenges and opportunities of the green and digital transitions, and also to deal with the economic and social impact of the crisis. To that end, member states will have to submit their recovery and resilience plans together with their national reform programs, the process which would should take place from the 1st of January if everything goes well and the Next Generation EU agreement is finally approved in all its details and it's passed as legislation. So they will have to submit, the member states will have to submit these recovery and resilience plans in order to apply for the funding that is provided by this recovery and resilience instrument. So it will this money will be these plans will in fact be incorporated to the European semester annual cycle, and together with the annual sustainable growth survey, the European Commission also launched on the 17th of September guidelines to the member states on how to compose, how to write these plans so that they facilitate the European Commission's work for assessing them and maximize their chances of obtaining the funding they will seek for investment and reform.
But what is your assessment on the recovery plan that was reached in July?
Well, I think that the agreement to provide, in addition to the EU budget, which for which we would have to reach an agreement to provide it, because the current multi-annual financial framework is coming to an end. So this agreement on this next generation EU pillar, recovery money, I think it's a historical step, because this is the first time that the EU will borrow in the financial markets in order to provide funding to the member states to manage the differentiated impact of a shock that has been common. I mean, the pandemic has been everywhere. However, its consequences, its impact has been different across member states. And in the case of the euro area, shocks like this have been very problematic in the past, because member states no longer had their own monetary policy, which they could use in order to stabilize their economies, like to stop unemployment from increasing. And there have been quite tight constraints also on their fiscal policies, public spending and taxation. So it has been quite a long-held quest that the EU or the Eurozone develops interstate transfers, the transfers of money that go from one member state to the other to deal with these different shocks. In that sense, if this program, the Next Generation EU, manages to succeed in its objectives, it is quite possible that it will pave the way for establishing a more permanent fiscal capacity for the EU and the Eurozone. And by fiscal capacity, I mean the EU at the EU level or the Eurozone level, we will have the possibility to draw revenues. In this case, we are borrowing, or perhaps at some future stage, we could have taxes. So funds, and distribute them to member states so that they can deal with different shocks that happen in their economy. So in that sense, my first sort of point of assessment for the agreement of July is that this is a historical step. The second thing that I wanted to say is that the funds from this Recovery and Resilience Fund are more likely to help with the recovery and the rebuilding of the economies that will receive them. And that is because the earliest that some of that money will start flowing into the member states is going to be 2021. By that time, we may be already experiencing some gradual return to normality because of vaccines coming our way. And the flow of funds will also start increasing as we move further on to 2022, 2023. So in that respect, member states will have to carry on supporting their economy right now, supporting incomes of households and companies. They have to carry on borrowing.
But in your opinion, what were the downsides of the agreement?
I would say most notably, there was an important downscaling of the Just Transition Fund, which had been proposed by the Commission in May, last May. And there were also cuts in research funding, which is the kind of funding that has actually enabled people to discover, to develop the vaccine that is likely to get us out of this pandemic, which according to scientists is probably not the last one we're going to experience. And the last point that I would like to make is that there are still quite a few loose ends that need to be figured out regarding the recovery and resilience plans. How will the process of approving these plans is going to evolve? How the disbursement of money will work out? What kind of conditions will be put into place? How the compliance with the general objectives will be assessed? And how the pursuit of different economic and social objectives will be squared?
Before we started recording, you told me that such changes will most likely modify the European semester process. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
So for the next 3 years, when the disbursement of the recovery and resilience facility, the disbursement of money from that facility is supposed to take place, the European semester will be modified and will be centered around these recovery and resilience plans. I mean, at the first stage, they will have to be approved in their principles, in their objectives, in their goals, and then their implementation will have to be monitored. And money will be disbursed as long as the European Commission and the Council of Ministers are happy with the way that these plans are being implemented. This means two things. On the one hand, the national reform plans, which used to outline what policies other than fiscal member states were planning to take in line with the country-specific recommendations that had been issued to them in the previous year. These national reform plans will be integrated in the recovery and resilience plan. And for those member states that will actually submit such plans, because it's not obligatory to seek funding from this facility. So for those member states that will submit such plans, there will be no country-specific recommendation. So the European semester is going to look somewhat different for at least the next 3 years.
Well, on a slightly different note, the Commission released a few weeks ago the economic forecast for 2021, and as we would expect, they don't really show a positive picture. They predict that the European economy will contract by almost 8%. In your opinion, what is really driving the recession?
Well, we have different kinds of shocks. Lockdowns mean that entire sectors, businesses in entire sectors have to stop producing if teleworking is not possible. So there is a reduction in how much output services are being produced in an economy. So the economy shrinks because of that. But at the same time, the people who work in those sectors, they lose part or some of their income, depending on what the situation is, whether they put on job retention programs, if they cannot telework, whether they become completely fired, so they have to fall back onto unemployment benefits if they have that possibility. So because the income of people is reduced because they lose their jobs or their hours are shrinking, they seek to consume less, which also then means that there is less demand in the economy and the economy shrinks. Beyond that, however, there is the question of uncertainty, because they are, even if they have not lost their jobs, people may who still have a salary to live on may start saving more, because they feel that if the crisis goes on for a few more months, they may also lose their job, so they try to, space out their consumption between now and the future. Companies, because of this uncertainty, may not, be undertaking investment, which creates demand, but also creates capital to keep on producing in the more medium to long term. And of course, people, they don't consume also because they are afraid to, to travel, to go eat in restaurants, to pursue activities that involve social interaction and proximity to others. I should perhaps mention here that what is really important for this recession is that the sectors that have been hit the most are sectors in services, hotels and restaurants, traveling, the arts sector. These are all sectors that are very labor intensive. So a given fall in the demand for these kinds of services means that we should expect a relatively higher increase in unemployment. So many more people lose their jobs. These are also sectors where people do not earn very high salaries, which means that, if they lose this salary, they may not have as many savings to fall back into, and therefore the reduction in their consumption is also going to be bigger than if it was people in other better paid sectors that are losing their jobs. And of course, these are also sectors that tend to concentrate in larger quantities groups in the labor market that traditionally have been more disadvantaged, women, younger people, and which may have a greater propensity to actually drop out of the labor market, or in the case of younger people, delay entering it.
The Commission, however, gives a more positive outlook for next year, predicting that the EU economy will grow by roughly 4%. Do you think this is at all possible? And if so, what is going to drive the recovery?
Well, the return to normality is going to drive the recovery, but then how strong this recovery is going to be will depend, I think, on how well we will have managed to contain long-term scars and damage in the economy. And these long-term scars and damage in the economy have to do with, as I mentioned earlier, for example, people dropping out or being stuck out of the labor market. So not just not having a job, but also stop looking for one because they don't think they're going to get one. They have received too many rejections, or people being stuck in very bad jobs, very temporary jobs. These longer term damage in the economy may also involve, you know, companies closing down and therefore liquidating their capital. It is possible if many companies close down that when demand of people for goods and services returns, there may not be enough companies to provide, to serve this demand and to hire people to, you know, to work there because, I don't know, the hotel has been shut down or the restaurant has been shut down or a factory has been shut down because of the prolonged crisis and, you know, the inability to deal with their financial obligations. So it should be pointed out precisely that because the current recession has hit services sector by more, the risk is also that the recovery may not be as fast because consumers cannot necessarily consume the services they have not been allowed to buy during the confinement. So if, for example, I haven't been to the hairdresser, you know, during autumn or during spring, I may go once I am again allowed or I feel safe enough to go, but I'm not going to have two haircuts or, you know, two hair colorings at the same time. I mean, the services that I didn't buy during the confinement, you're not going to make up for it. So that means that the recovery may also be sort of more long drawn out because these are the sectors that have been affected the most. And of course, the fact that you said that the economy will grow is forecasted under the current sort of assumptions to grow by 4.1 in 2022 after having shrunk by 7.8% in 2021. It means that by the end of 2022, the economy will still be smaller than what it was in 2019 before the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
So basically what we're going to lose in the following year with a 4.1 forecasted growth in the year after that, we're not going to go back to where we were before, right before the pandemic started. So we will still be having a smaller economy.
The autumn package also launches a joint employment report that provides an annual overview of the key employment and social developments in Europe. You have obviously depicted quite a grim picture of the European labour market, and rightfully so. Do you think that the policy measures that have been put in place both at the European and national level have been enough to act as a safety net?
Well, up until now, it seems that the extent of these measures has been unprecedented. Member states did not just fall back on the unemployment benefit systems that they had before, but they also extended the eligibility for those to many other people in the labor market that were not eligible before that. They created new types of benefits. For example, if somebody has to stay at home to quarantine, technically, he's not unemployed, but you know, he may not be able to go to work. So benefits have been created also for situations like this. Still, despite the unprecedented extent to which governments have rolled out support, according to survey data by the Eurofound, over half of the unemployed respondents that to their online survey did not receive any official support, which suggests there are still important gaps in replacing the incomes that people lose because of the situation in the labor market. And as we go forward in the crisis, in the pandemic, there is a risk that these gaps in protection grow bigger, because governments have had to run large budget deficits to pay for these measures. So they have been spending more than what they have been receiving in taxes, and therefore they have had to borrow, which increases their public debt to levels that had not been seen before, even in countries like Greece, for example. And although many influential voices from policymaking and academia urge government to not roll back the support, to do whatever it takes to keep on supporting households and firms during the crisis, it's not clear whether governments may not start thinking about how far they can go and hold back. There may also be, you know, an element of ideology here, because the current support measures, I mean, when you expand your spending so much, it means that the size of the state in the economy is growing, and not all governments are necessarily happy with that. So they may try, I mean, ideologically driven governments against big state may try to put a brake on these support measures. And I think we have already seen, for example, that during this second, this current second wave, governments have been visibly more reluctant to close down sectors to stem the spread of the virus, because when you order a sector to shut down, you have to offer some support. So we have seen that, you know, they were not as fast as in spring in doing that. Going now more specifically to short-time work and job retention schemes, there is also the question of how long should these schemes carry on as purely income support schemes, just replacing part or the entire salary of the people participating in them, given that at the same time that we're having this recession, the economy also is undergoing some restructuring. Some jobs, in other words, will no longer exist after the pandemic is over, because the way we do things is very likely to change. For example, you know, we may be doing our shopping much more through electronic shops than going to actual retailers in high streets. Or we may no longer travel as much just to attend work meetings for an hour or two, and we may just use Zoom. So these are, you know, cases of sectors where the demand will never come, is likely to never come back to where it was before the pandemic, because the way the economy functions has changed. So there is a question, therefore, we need to keep on supporting the incomes of people, but at the same time, we need to make sure that when the recovery begins, they're enabled and ready to move on to getting either their old jobs or new jobs, which means that at some point, this income support will have to be combined with policies, with measures that, for example, retrain these people, reskill them. So it's very important, I think, not to move too fast, roll back the income support too fast. So in that sense, I would think that it is fairly possible that we may have to consider whether the SURE should be extended for some time if the pandemic does not wind down too fast.
In your upcoming chapter in Benchmarking Working Europe that is coming out in December, you state that the European Central Bank's response to this crisis has been quite different compared to the one of the previous decade. Why is this so?
It has been quite a sharp contrast with the reaction of the ECB to the beginning of the crisis in the beginning of the previous decade. So the European Central Bank has reacted much more speedily and, more importantly, much more decisively and unequivocally to support economic activity and fiscal responses. That is, the capacity of member states' governments to borrow in the markets at very low interest rates. Which was something that was not the case in 2010 with Greece and other Eurozone periphery countries. I mean, this time the ECB moved very fast. I mean, it launched its pandemic emergency purchase program in mid-March. And under this program, it had initially pledged to buy private and public securities, that is, bonds, which is what governments provide in order to borrow money from the markets. Initially, it had pledged 700 billion euros to be spent until the end of 2020. And as soon as in June, it had extended this amount to 1.350 trillion euros, as well as extending the duration of the program to at least the end of June 2021. They have also been far more actively encouraging banks to lend money to businesses and households by providing them liquidity at a preferential interest rate. So yeah, I do see a difference, and this is something actually that is sort of, one can see the results in the financial markets, because no Eurozone economy has faced any difficulty issuing debt, borrowing money in order to support these unprecedented measures that they have been rolled out since last March. And we can say that this has been really the result, the impact of the policies that the European Central Bank put into place.
But Sotiria, do you think that this argument also holds true for those countries that are so heavily in debt, such as southern European countries, Portugal, Spain, Italy and Greece? Or would you see for these countries possibly a rise in deficit and public debt?
Well, for now, there are no problems, as I mentioned, even for these countries to keep on borrowing to provide support to their economies, thanks to the ECB response, but also thanks to the suspension of the application of the EU's fiscal rules, the Stability and Growth Pact. In other words, member states, all of them, I think by now, will be are forecasted to well exceed the 3% of GDP budget deficit that the fiscal rules stipulate, and they will not be punished, so they will not be penalized for that. And the latter is the suspension of the fiscal rules will last at least until the end of 2021, while from what I heard, Paolo Gentiloni, the EU Commissioner for the Economy and Financial Affairs, has already publicly posed the question of whether this suspension should be carried forward to 2022. Still, the expectation is that while budget deficits shrink once the recovery begins, once the economy starts growing again, as governments will have to hand out fewer benefits and as their GDP is going to grow, there will still be quite a substantial public debt that will have been accumulated and which will eventually have to be back. I mean, there are member states that are going to be, for by 2021, 2022, their public debt is going to reach well above 100% of their GDP. They will be owing more than what they produce in 1 year. Greece, most notably, will be just over 200% of its GDP, its public debt. But also other countries like France, Portugal, Italy, they will all be quite burdened with public debt.
I think this question would just come automatic, but then do you expect another debt crisis?
I don't think it can be entirely ruled out, because such amounts of debt that I mentioned will take well over a decade to be reversed. They will take a long time. I think whether we're going to have another debt crisis or not will depend on a large extent on policy decisions. Decisions that have to do with how to reform the EU's fiscal rules, because right before the pandemic had hit us, there was this public debate and, in fact, public consultation that the European Commission had launched on how to reform the EU's economic governance framework, which includes the fiscal rules. So we will have to see what kind of decisions will be made in that direction. For the moment, that discussion has been put aside, at least officially. We will also have to see how successfully the next generation EU will manage to support the recovery, because, you know, the faster an economy grows, the more output it produces so that it can pay its debt in a way that reassures investors that it will be able to pay this debt. So we will have to see how fast economies grow, but we will also have to see how the ECB may change its policies. If the European Central Bank decided to start increasing the interest rate, then governments may start finding it more expensive to borrow from the financial markets. And this is what, you know, this is a manifestation of a debt crisis. A government has to pay so much interest rate in order to borrow that it can no longer borrow from the financial market and it needs to seek financial support. The ECB has signaled that it will keep interest rates low for quite a long time. And if I judge from the leadership of the European Central Bank, I think they're quite dovish, as we call them, policymakers. However, as I said, paying back all this debt is going to take a very long time. So forecasts become more uncertain if we look 10 or 15 years down the line.
Do you think that this crisis is opening up a window of opportunity for the implementation of more equitable policies, or rather, do you envision another austerity wave?
It's not, I cannot rule it out. I am not sure, though, whether it would be the kind of austerity as a product of a conditionality that we saw, being imposed in countries like Greece and Portugal and Cyprus in the previous crisis. I mean, austerity means that member states will have to cut their spending and increase their taxes in a way that you know, harms the economy when the economy would have needed more public spending in order to, you know, grow, we cut down on these things. This is not the only way to bring down public debt. As I mentioned, we can have, you know, economies may grow. Although if we also try to engineer a transition to a carbon neutral economy, I'm not sure whether we can still aim for, you know, high enough growth rates in output so that paying back the public debt will be a painless, totally painless process. However, there can be also other ways. For example, we can increase the taxation base. So not increase how much tax household or wage earners or pay on what they earn, but make sure that more people, more sort of income earners pay their taxes. And I mean, clamping down, for example, on tax avoidance on digital companies could be one way to do that. Having imposing environmental taxes could be another way of doing that, and using, you know, the revenues to provide benefits to those that are sort of poorer and suffer more from the increased energy prices because of this tax. Also, last but not least, there is another way to reduce public debt, is to be okay with a little bit higher inflation than the 2% that has been the target of the European Central Bank until now. Because the more the stronger, the faster inflation is, the more the real value of debt becomes lower, and so we can pay it off. So while I don't think that you know, a new austerity wave can be entirely ruled out, I would have this hope that we have learned some lessons from the crisis of the previous decade that left lots of scars, not just social but also political, with the rise of anti-system politics across Europe that ultimately threaten, you know, the European integration project itself.
So Tidia, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you with me today. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you. I also enjoyed our discussion very much.
Do watch out for Sotiria's upcoming chapter in Benchmarking Work in Europe 2020. The publication will be available at ety.org/publications beginning from the second half of December.